board.
Thank you. Wow, that's great. So we're going to do that at the start of every departmental meeting now going forward. I'd like to welcome everyone here for today's roundtable discussion. Restating the state of the discipline, my name's Peter Trubowitz, and as head of the IR department, I basically have been given the honor of welcoming you. I mean, for those of you who are baseball fans, this feels a little bit like I've been asked to throw out the first ceremonial pitch, and I appreciate it. I'm not going to test your patience. George Lawson will do the formal introductions of the panel, and moderate the discussion this afternoon. But I wanted to say just a few things. I mean, I think the first thing to say is that today's roundtable is very much the capstone to an important new initiative in the department. As many of you know, the department this year has funded four research workshop programs in the subfields or clusters of international security and conflict, international institutions and law, international political economy, and IR theory. And we launched the initiative, the department, for a number of reasons, but I think there's two to flag here that are particularly relevant to mention. The first was to kind of strengthen the department's commitment to and reputation for intellectual debate and scholarly engagement, in part by bringing in very high-octane performers like those we have here today. The second was to give PhD students you've never been called a high-octane performer before, really more opportunities to present work, present their research, to critique the work of others, and to lead in organizing scholarly events like today's roundtable. And while this is still, the department effort is still very much a work in progress, I think we've made good progress this year. I know many people feel the same way here in the audience. And as the head of department, I can tell you, you know, that it's very gratifying to have students look at what you're trying to do and say, you know, that's good, but we can do better. And that's really what's happened here. So shortly after we launched the workshops last October, Aaron, Pilar, Oksana, and Assad came to me, Tarek Barkawi, and Mark Hoffman, and said, hey, why don't we take the research workshop idea and kind of build on it by creating a final event that's organized around a theme that cuts across the workshops and brings us all together, a kind of, I don't know, like a meta workshop on the state of the discipline. So we said, hey, that's a really great idea, and we did what we really needed to do, which was get out of their way. And the four of them really did what they needed to do, which was to bring in some very good people, to plan it all out, to work with Gabrielle and Sophie in making it happen. And so before I forget, please join me in thanking Aaron, Pilar, Oksana, and Assad for really all their hard work in organizing today's event. Okay, so I've thrown out the first ceremonial pitch, and I'm sure exhausted your patience for sports metaphors, so I'm going to turn it over to George Lawson. George?
Sure, I'll come up there. Well, welcome, everyone. It's a great pleasure. My name is George Lawson. I'm Associate Professor in the department. It's a great pleasure to welcome you to this inaugural roundtable event to celebrate the PhD's faculty workshops we've been running over the last few months. And welcome to this room, which one of my colleagues has just said is the only part of the LSE campus that feels like a kind of Disneyland version of what a university campus is supposed to look like. No mentioning who that was, but I hope you enjoyed the room. It's actually not it's a great room in some ways. It's not such a great room in others, and the acoustics aren't very good. So we'll actually get the speakers to come up here. And when it comes to the Q&A part of the discussion, if you can wait and a mic will come around and you can speak nice and clearly into that, then we'll be able to have the conversation that we'd like to have. So I'll just introduce the four speakers, then they'll get their chance to do their stuff in the order that I introduce them. Our first speaker is going to be Aisha Zarakol from Cambridge University, and Aisha is someone who works on security, but with underpinning her work on security, interests in social theory and historical sociology. Therefore, she's on my team today, effectively. People probably know Aisha's work oriented to some substantive degree around the concept of stigma and the work that stigma does in ordering international order into a particular set of hierarchies. In her 2011 book, After Defeat, used the example of non-Western regional powers such as Turkey, Japan, and Russia during the modern international order and their defeat in war to understand modern international order as this hierarchical realm underpinned by this notion of stigma. And she subsequently used that work to develop her own work on hierarchy in a recent article in International Organization and an edited volume that will be coming out later this year. Our second speaker will be Elizabeth Bruegel from the Graduate Institute in Geneva. Elizabeth works on international governance and particularly the gendered components of international governance over a very wide range of domains, agriculture, conflict, and neoliberalism. Colleagues will probably know her work from her 1999 book, The Global Construction of Gender, and more recently her 2011 book, Transforming Masculine Rule. And our third speaker at the end there will be Matthew Watson from the University of Warwick. Matthew works on the concept and practices of markets, how they're understood, how they're produced, how they're embedded in everyday experience, how they work as a kind of common sense that both routinizes and normalizes them, but at the same time also leads to various ways in which they're rethought and sometimes resisted. He's published very widely on these themes, most recently his 2014 book, Uneconomic Economies and Crisis of the Model World, which is a title that's quite hard to say, but actually a very good title, I think. One aside here, Matthew actually has a range of websites, and on one of the websites there's a lot of professional development activity, so particular colleagues and students may be interested in going on there. There's a range of podcasts on topics as varied as peer review and how to survive it, fellowship applications, and so on. I spent hours nevertheless going through some of those podcasts, and I certainly recommend them for anyone going through those type of processes. Fourth and finally, we'll have Oliver Kessler from Erfurt University. Oliver's interests have considerable overlap with Matthew's, actually, in terms of being interested in the social construction of markets, how they operate, how they're understood, and how expertise, particularly around statistics, helps us understand how they're both formed and regulated, particularly when it comes to financial markets. But he's also taught and published very widely on international law, including in an excellent Millennium Forum from last year around the status of law in world society. So our speakers have been asked to speak around the general theme of innovations in IR, this cross-cutting theme that Peter said we were going to organize discussions around, with three different dimensions to that. Think of some recent innovations in your particular area of interest, in your particular subfield. Think about some future innovations. If you haven't done this, you've still got a minute to do so now. And then also think about the promise of these particular innovations, both intellectually and also potentially in terms of their politics and their political implications. So we'll see whether that's actually what you've done. It doesn't really matter if you have or you haven't, but that's what you were asked to do. So the speakers will get 10 minutes each, and then we'll open things up for Q&A and hopefully have a lively discussion. So first, before we welcome Aisha up, perhaps we could welcome all of our speakers, please, LSE.
Thank you. Thank you, George. And thank you, everyone. It's a great pleasure to be here today. And I have followed the rules, and I will talk about the three prompts we were given. But before I do that, I want to actually ask a bigger question as to why innovations are needed in IR, what's driving this interest in innovations. So thinking about that question, I came up with three answers, and I think the answers actually influence how we evaluate whether innovations are lasting or they make a genuine contribution. So I want to start with that and then move to, you know, what are recent innovations and what are going to be some future trends. So thinking about why IR needs innovations, I think three answers are possible. One is the easy careerist answer, to the extent that, you know, IR, even though it's changing, it's becoming a global discipline, to some extent is still dominated by American approaches, and American approaches to international relations and political science are dominated by positivist approaches, and there is a, within that particular framework, there's this notion of, you know, progressive science. So I think there is a kind of a drive coming from there where scholars are supposed to show that they make worthwhile contributions by innovating. In practice, this is really hard to execute. So what it looks like in practice is usually either some type of ignorance. I mean, I see this, you know, in my job as an editor or reading vivas of PhD students where some kind of innovation is claimed or some kind of novel contribution is claimed, but that just shows that the person hasn't really read beyond their narrow corner of the discipline. Or more seriously, there's some kind of methodological innovation, right? The new methods, and this is what's supposed to be the you know, big contribution. So I think we have to acknowledge that a lot of what goes under the name of innovation in international relations is just change in methods or methodological approaches. So there's that particular logic. A second reason why I think there's an interest in innovations in international relations is this is how our debates proceed. I mean, some of our questions are very old questions. Is it, you know, ideational or material, you know, in age and structure. And every generation, there is, you know, battle lines are drawn and, you know, labels. So these same debates reanimate under new labels. And then, you know, at some point, the debate is exhausted. There's a backlash. And then people, you know, go to their corners. And then the next generation rediscovers or re-innovates that the same debate under new labels. So what goes under the name of innovation there is actually just a change in label. I mean, there is progress. I don't mean to discount that, but I think a lot of what we consider innovation is just old wine in new bottles. And the third reason why we are actually interested in innovations as a discipline, I think, is because in some ways we do genuinely lack and ways of dealing with world problems and world politics as a relatively modern discipline with a particular history. I mean, there is still a lot of ground to cover. So, I mean, there are genuine explanatory holes, and we try to fill them. And we try to innovate explanations. And this usually looks in practice as, you know, us going to other disciplines and learning from other disciplines, borrowing from their toolkit, and then bringing that, what we learn, to into back into international relations as an innovation. So I think this is, most of the time, this is what's happening. And after, I think, since the breakdown of the paradigms and the end of the paradigm wars, these logics have gathered even more speed because this is how, you know, conversations are had. Now, recognizing these logics is important because especially one and two, you know, innovation in methods and innovation in labeling, I think they have kind of expiration dates built into them. Their logics dictate that, you know, they have to be replaced. You know, new methods, we have to keep coming up with new methods, or we have to keep coming up with new labels. And it's, I think, really in the area of three, you know, explanatory holes that the genuine innovations can be had, although, we, you know, it still remains to be seen. how to borrow from other disciplines, how to learn from other disciplines. It shouldn't be just a matter of going and taking a particular philosopher or thinker or social theorist and just applying them, and this is often what we do. So this is how I think about innovations. Let me talk about some of the innovations I've been involved in and grade them according to this criteria that I just set out. One thing that I'm tangentially involved in is the practice turn, which is very popular, and it's an innovation in the sense that I see students being very interested in it. A lot of people are writing about it. But if you look at, if you evaluate the practice turn according to these logics that I've identified, I think it's, in some ways it's all three, right? It's kind of a methodological innovation. At the same time, it may be, again, old wine in new bottles, is constructivism under a new name, right? These are debates that are being had. But it did also, at least in its initial forms, try to answer some questions that hadn't been answered about how, you know, diplomats, etc., interact with each other. But to the extent it's more one and two as opposed to three, I think it's almost inevitable, and we are already seeing the backlash against practice turn and the critiques, and then it will move into the next cycle in its life where it will be abandoned at some point, and then somebody is going to reinvent the practice turn under some other label. Other innovations I've been involved in. I've worked quite a bit in social theory. My work, as George said, interacts with elements of social theory. So one area there that has seen great growth is the concept of ontological security. The first article I wrote dealt with ontological security. I review pieces in ontological security all the time. I think there's a lot of interest there. And I think it allowed, it allowed us to talk about social behavior of states, identities of states, in a world that was dominated by conversations about physical material security. But you could also argue that it's, again, the identity turn under another name, and it's already having its backlash, right? So there are these life cycles. The concept of stigma that I borrowed from Goffman, but also Alias, is potentially more promising, and so is the historical turn and the turn to global history. And finally, there's the work that I've been involved in terms of conceptualizing world politics as hierarchy as opposed to anarchy, which is supposed to be not so much of an innovation, but a space-clearing exercise that allows for actual innovation by lifting some of the blind spots that have obstructed our way. And the reason why I think these latter are more promising potentially is because they go to this third logic that I've discussed, filling real explanatory holes. Taking a stand back and trying to understand the world. Because international relations, it's very fragmented. We spend a lot of time navel gazing, trying to understand, what are we doing, what's international relations is all about. But that curse is also a blessing. We're uniquely, as a field, as a discipline, uniquely positioned to be more of a kind of a meta discipline that can actually create conversations between different realms of social sciences and humanities. And I think it's only in doing that we can arrive at genuine innovation in international relations by trying to identify trans-historical concepts and dynamics that travel across space and time. And that's where I see real innovation in my corner of the field. And I'll end there. Thank you. Thank you.
Well, I didn't follow the instructions. But I continue a theme of threes, so I guess I'm in a way also in line. Thinking about the state of the discipline, which is, I think, the title of this roundtable, always generates an identity conflict in myself, because first of all, I have to accept that IR is a discipline. And then I have to ask myself, as somebody who has always been marginal in the discipline and who sees herself as interdisciplinary and is associated with gender studies in particular, which again is interdisciplinary, I'm not entirely sure which discipline I'm talking about. So bear with me on this a little bit. There's something odd about me in addition, because I sit in Geneva, and people in Geneva actually think that practical things matter, which to somebody who is critiquing constantly is a very interesting place to be. Now, trying to think about where to start with these comments, I found myself going back to Kratochwil and Ruggie's old article that I know all of you know, International Organization, A State of the Art on an Art of the State from 1986. And what I find really comforting about this article is they were talking about a state of the art of an art of the state, not the state of the art of the art of the art of the state. So there is obviously multiples to be had here, and I'm trying to try one of them. What Kratochwil and Ruggie were trying to do in this article is they were trying to tell us that maybe there is something wrong in not conceptualizing international regimes as sociological. The phenomena were sociological, and so therefore this would require maybe some different research approaches, post-positivist research approaches in particular. Regimes are out of date. I was supposed to talk about innovations, don't worry. I'm not going to talk about regimes. But the institutionalist research program, of course, is still alive. It has gotten in various editions, principal agent theory, regime complexity. We're now talking about organizational approaches, and I'm particularly going to piggyback on the Barnett and Finmore article from 1999, also not innovative, in which they talk about the pathologies of international organizations. And I think it's interesting to know that this is still the top cited article from the journal International Organizations. I happened to look that up, and that's what it says on the website. But I would like to suggest to you that there is maybe something to be gained by going beyond Weber, which is basically what Barnett and Finmore base their work on, to go beyond even institutions and organizations. And of course, there is a lot that has been done on this already. We have practice theories that have been introduced now from Marx to Bourdieu. We have theories of performance from the ethnomethodologists to Judith Butler. We have discourse theories from the early Foucault to the Foucault of governmentality, and there are network theories, science and technology studies, the new materialism, and so on. I find my own work, I find myself drawing most extensively on the latter categories, and I would like to suggest to you that much could be gained from, much can be gained. Not everybody has to be doing this, right? But much can be gained from embracing this kind of theories. I'm going to try to make that argument by letting you know about some of the elements of my current project on gender experts and gender expertise in international organizations. And here come the threes. I think there's three gains to be made in particular. I think one gain from going beyond Weber, going beyond institutions, going beyond organizations, is that it makes visible other social forms in international spaces. And in particular with Bourdieu, of course, it makes visible transnational social fields. It makes visible spaces that are not codified. Expert networks seems to me are one example of such social fields that would not otherwise be visible. Gender experts and gender expertise is mainstreamed throughout governmental institutions and organizations, both at the international as well as at the national level. There's an social organization to those networks. We did a survey of gender experts in international organizations, and we asked them, for example, who are the most influential experts in your field, and lo and behold, LSC and IDS Sussex seem to be the places where those people seem to gain their inspiration from. I thought you would like to know that. So there's clearly hierarchies in this social field. There is a common knowledge anchored very marginally, but to some extent in gender studies. There's internal tensions and there's internal arguments. This is not new. The other people have talked about it. They've talked about it in the form of talking about transnational advocacy networks. Keck and Sicking, of course, have talked about it in the form of epistemic communities. Peter Haas, of course. But I think there is a second gain to be had by going beyond international institutions. And that has to, going beyond Weber in this case, really more. And this has to do with bringing into focus the notion of productive power. I'm drawing here on Barnett and Duval. Again, there seems to be in much of the literature in international governance, and including the literature on expertise, a sense that one has to ask, well, what is expertise good for? The answer then typically is it provides legitimacy, it makes policies happen, it makes things happen. But expertise is productive in other ways, in addition. It's productive, and here I would like to give you a few examples from the discourse on gender and food security, which is one kind of expertise I have been looking at. It's productive through identity constructions. We have the image of the woman farmer on the one hand, of the motherly, caring, subsistence-oriented food provider on the other. Those images populate this discourse and make possible different kinds of things. It's productive through problem definitions. What is the problem made out to be? Is the problem food insecurity or is the problem gender inequality? It is productive through the logics provided. Is the logic of why we should be engaging in policies around gender equality related to the fact that, as the World Bank puts it, gender equality is smart economics, or is it a matter of human rights? Again, this makes possible different kinds of policies. And of course, it is productive through a variety of technologies of government, of agential artifacts, of governance, indicators, rankings, best practices, checklists, and so on. This literature is, of course, out there. In Geneva, we have a new phenomenon called the International Gender Champions, which is an effort to get heads of agencies and missions to pledge for gender equality. It seems to me that the notion of the pledge itself is a very interesting phenomenon. It's a speech act. It's a commissive, right? I will be doing something, and it produces results. It also puts all these heads of agencies on what Anna Leander calls a whitelist. We don't have blacklists anymore, but we have whitelists. Everybody's a certified gender expert as long as you pledge. And again, this creates particular realities. Finally, the third contribution from going beyond Weber would be, in my idea, to go to Marx. And if you want to understand gender issues, I think, and this is a little unconventional, actually, for gender theorists who are all doing Butler at this point. I really think in order to understand intersectional gender relations, we need to go back to understanding state theory and thinking about international governance through the lens of state theory. States are a solidification of the interests of social forces. They are an arena for negotiation, including negotiation along categories of class, gender, sexual orientation, ethnicities, abilities, age, etc. I find this in particularly urgent in the context of the contemporary, what I've called the neoliberalization of feminism that we're seeing around the world. And I will give you just the most glaring example of that. I have seen recently the meeting, the visit of Justin Trudeau to the White House, which led to the establishment of the United States-Canada Council for the Advancement of Women Entrepreneurs and Business Leaders. This is what the White House website has to say about this. President Trump wants to pave the way for women to bring their unique perspectives and strengths to the business world and to harness the full potential of female entrepreneurs in our economy to make America great again. What's interesting here, and what is actually not that atypical in this neoliberalized form of feminism, is that the focus is on women, all of them, all the same, whose potential is always that they are potential entrepreneurs, and they will do their neoliberal thing in the economy in order to, and then you fill it in, either whatever, and make America great again. I mean, it's building peace, fighting corruption, ending war. All of those things can happen through this kind of a particular argument. So, and I think this we are talking here about an international discourse. We're talking about an international phenomenon that I think in its whole breadth cannot be understood without going back to thinking about interests, about the competition of interests, and of the way in which the state, right, and I'm including in that the internationalized state and the various forms of the system that the state has taken in an era of globalization, without taking those into account. Thank you.
Hello, everyone. Aisha started by saying that she was going to follow the instructions. Elizabeth started by saying that she hadn't. I think I'd better start by saying that I'm not even sure I could have followed the instructions even if I tried to. Confession time at the beginning, because you look like a nice, friendly crowd. I don't have a background in IR at all. I've never been trained in IR. I conduct a style of IPE scholarship that probably doesn't rely on IR in any way. I even wrote a book back in 2005 that wondered aloud what an IPE might look like were it shorn of its usual anchor within IR theory. This was a thought experiment more than anything else, but looking at different ways in which international political economy might be studied. There is a tendency, I think, amongst IPE scholars to search for the grand narrative of the era that we live in, to try to ascribe a character and a name to that era. I wondered what happened, though, if we looked really down at the micro level to see what was going on in people's lives, to begin to wonder what it might mean to look at those everyday livelihood struggles that set people against the life that is often carved out for them. And so I might be a slightly unusual invitee to a roundtable on the future of IR, when everything within my background would suggest that I really don't know these debates at all. I could stand here and try to convince you that I do, but I'm not very good at bluffing. Anyone can take money off me when I play cards. All it would take was, I think, one raised eyebrow, and I would cave in immediately and confess that I really don't know the IR literature at all. Hopefully, however, this doesn't completely undermine my reason for being here. Maybe now I've waited until I've given you reason to doubt whether I should be here, I'll say thank you very much for the invitation and that I'm delighted to be here, because the main issue, I think, still for IPE scholars is exactly what the relationship between IPE and IR should be. I'm not sure that this is a conversation that's ever really been had fully within the IPE community, and I think that invitations such as this one hopefully allow us to go at least one step further in at least bringing that issue to broader attention. Innovations is the theme of the panel. Innovation sounds to me as though it might be right for a subject field that has some sense of what its history is, that has some sense of what its present is, that has some sense that there might be a core to conversations within the subject field, a core that might be reinforced, or a core that through innovations might be questioned in some way. I'm not sure that IPE in its relative youth really has got to that position at all. So I think a lot of the questions for IPE scholars are much more fundamental than the question of its future, because its future will never become into view unless it has a good sense of what its presence is. And its presence is inevitably, I think, wrapped up in some way to a relationship with international relations theory, but in way or ways that aren't immediately clear. So the question of the future for IR from an IPE perspective is whether that future for IR will continue to entwine IPE to its historical roots within international relations theory. There is a relationship here, but it's a relationship that's usually, almost always actually, one way. There is an assimilation that takes place. Innovations in IPE are often borrowed directly from what's already happened within the international relations literature. I'm not sure that this necessarily has to be the case. One of the people that was a predecessor in the chair that I currently hold at Warwick is also well known to some of the older colleagues at the LSE, is Susan Strange. And Susan once made the rather provocative statement that actually everything in this field was IPE, and that IR was a subset of IPE, really, and not the other way around. Well, Susan loved to stir the pot, and I think she did it wonderfully within that one statement. Whether anyone else in IPE really believes that, however, I think is another question altogether. So there is this, I think, very interesting issue of borders and frontiers and boundaries that may be a particular for IPE scholars in the context of our roundtable, because we in general probably don't know where we are yet, and when we're asking ourselves where we might want to be in the future, presumably that infers a trajectory that goes through where we are now. But if we're not sure where we are now, that probably becomes a slightly difficult question to answer. Certainly, I don't think I have any great answer to that, and I would probably be the last person that would give a series of statements about what IPE needs. I think at one level, what IPE needs is probably fewer people saying what IPE needs, and just allowing people to discover their own position within not just one literature, but a variety of literatures. Because if IR is a borrowing literature, then IPE does this to the nth degree. That I'm not sure whether there is anything that looks like a fully contained and fully homogeneous IPE literature. I think IPE is necessarily about borrowing. The question then becomes, if we're looking at innovations, is whether it borrows the right things. But of course, what the right things are likely to be fairly personal to the particular theorist in question. I'm not sure there's any easy route map to try to present to you for what IPE should become. One of the things that IPE scholars have always seemed to do, though, and this isn't true of everyone, but it's true of enough of them to generalise about it, is to be influenced perhaps disproportionately by current events. IPE scholars have had a tendency to chase the news. If you look at the way that the big debates within IPE have developed over the 40-odd years of its self-declared life, then they have gone for big debates that seem to be specific to the context in which they were had. They almost go on a decade-by-decade basis. For a start, it was the collapse of Bretton Woods. Then it was the issue of hegemonic renewal, whether that was possible once you take the institutions of Bretton Woods away. Then it was the question about the embrace of free market economics. Then it was the question about globalization, neoliberalization, digitalization. Then it was the question of the global financial crisis and its multiple afterlives. And that maybe is what we have within the broad body of IPE scholarship, a tendency to take what is current and to try to build theoretical reflection from what is current and to use that as a means of exercising theoretical endeavor more generally. And I think if we're looking at the future of IPE, there are probably lots of current things that are likely to keep IPE scholars busy for years and years and years to come. Maybe if I'd have been here at this time last year, obviously this is your first roundtable, so I wouldn't have had an audience to address, but if I had been here at this time last year, there are still a number of aspects of the modern world that I think that would fit this tendency for IPE scholars to really focus on current events. I think IPE scholars probably have more to do to look at the way that the concept of economic world order in general has a history of its own that looks differently depending on where you view it from. That history is necessarily entwined with the history of religion, the history of race, and the history of politics in many different regions of the world, that makes it much more complicated than simply stating a single entity as a world order. I think IPE scholars probably have more to do as well to think through the process through which production within the global economy is moving towards Asia, not necessarily but predominantly towards East Asia, and what effect that's going to have on the way that IPE scholars undertake theory. I think this time last year it was also possible to detect some interesting undercurrents in the political arena that are obviously going to have an effect on the way that the world economy is managed. Nationalist populism might have struck in some unpredicted ways in 2016, but it was still an important part of the political debate even before then. I think IPE scholars could have been working on that more than they were at the time. And of course, the events of 2016 themselves, we're in a situation now where we don't really know what the future of regional economic integration is going to be post-Brexit. We don't really know what the future of the international trading order is going to be within the context of a Trump administration doing what Trump on the stump said he was going to do. All of this seems to point to a series of really big issues, and it might be that the really big issues will tell us much more about the future direction of IPE as a subject field. But of course, IPE scholars might have been here before. They've always been very good at identifying big issues. But do those big issues necessarily play themselves out in the way that is predicted? How do you distinguish between living through a period of flux, which I would suspect that we're definitely in at the moment, but how do you distinguish between when you're living through a period of flux, whether this will be genuinely transformational or what will emerge out of the other end will look transitory in 10, 20, 30 years' time. My old grandma would have talked about yesterday's fish and chip paper. And we don't know whether a lot of the big issues that are engaging both the intellectual and the political spirit of IPE scholars at the moment will turn into tomorrow's fish and chip paper. For the students who have just finished their teaching for the year, if you've got any spare time on your hand, it might be quite interesting to go back to some of the earlier IPE textbooks to look at the sorts of futures that were being predicted there. There is no shortage amongst the IPE textbook writers from the 1980s and the 1990s of making grand predictions of the future of the world. I'm not going to spoil the surprise by telling you what they are, but you'll be surprised because it won't be the type of world that you will have experienced in your lifetime, and it won't be the type of world that you've been reading in your history books either. A lot of the predictions simply didn't come true. The other issue about the contemporary period that I want to focus on a little bit as well, because it points IP, I think, in a different direction, is the emergence of the phenomenon of alternative facts, something that has become very current, but once again, I think I need to ask my own question once more as to whether this is going to be a lasting phenomenon or not. But within the realm of alternative facts, expertise is being more routinely questioned than ever before. If an expert says something that doesn't conform to your worldview, it looks as though you're now free to dismiss that and object to the fact that the claim was made on the basis of any authority whatsoever. Especially the expertise of economics and the expertise of economists has been questioned routinely. I think this has an interesting potential impact on IPE for a number of reasons. Firstly, lots of IPE scholars already work in a related area. They're already doing work on the governance effects of economic ideas. They're already looking at the way that economists and the knowledge that they're trained to hold is embedded in institutions and the effects that this has on the policies that then regulate everyday economic life. Recently, as well, there has been something of a debate about IPE schools and the methodology of IPE. This debate has been fought over really nothing more than whether economics provides a useful method for IPE scholars. So that whole shouting match that emerged a few years ago and thankfully has gone a little bit quieter in more recent times has been fought over economics as method. How much of what we are interested in as IPE scholars can simply be understood as a moment of market exchange and modelled in the same way that economists would model those. So the world is nothing other than very interesting at the moment. The world is nothing other than, I think, an open range for IPE scholars to get very excited that they might have something to say about it. I think if pushed, I would say that that was probably the priority for IPE scholars rather than reflecting too much on what their future should be. Their future might already be there for them and being governed by the politics of the present. Thank you very much.
So let me start by thanking the organizers for having me. It's a privilege to be here and to talk about the future of IR or IPE or however we want to call this beast. And here I have to start with an apology. For the next 10 minutes, probably you will think that I'm miserable and depressed. It's not the case, and I try to end up with a positive note, and I promise I try not to be funny, which for a German is never a good idea as well. The three questions that were given to us were innovations, the promise, and the future horizons. Now, the short answer, in case I extend my 10 minutes, the innovation I want to talk about is the practice turn, and I should touch upon it a bit. The promise, I don't see any, not as a turn. And the future, well, I said I'm going to end on a positive note. I would say then, well, it depends. It looks a bit bright. And given the audience, there's all hope in the room. But it very much depends. So let's first of all talk about the practice turn. And as Aisha has identified it, you cannot avoid it. You encounter it everywhere. It's known sometimes as new materialism, as the turn to ethnographic studies or ethnographic methodologies, or, well, it mirrors essentially the old saying of back to the things themselves that we heard about around the last turn of the century. The key idea, I think, is quite appealing. If you want to understand how diplomacy works, you go out and look what diplomats do. If you want to understand how investment banks work or derivative markets work, you ask, observe investment bankers and see what they do. Now, it's interesting and it's somehow appealing because, first of all, it's quite simple. You don't need to presume anything. You do away with all the big debates about emancipation and progress and science. You just do things. You get out. Get off your armchair and understand the world by actually engaging there, being there, and looking at it. It's also very sexy because, and I mean, here, as I said, it's all about Latour and Bourdieu and Boltanski, all these fancy French speakers, which make, as a German, me jealous because all that we have left is Habermas, and he's not the funniest guy around. And not very, I mean, it's not very sexy either. And I never was very particular fond of Habermas, but I mean, still, so I'd rather want to work with Latour and Bourdieu and Foucault and Derrida and all these people because they are avant-garde by probably just being French. And third, this is probably my hook now. It's the longer the turn continues, the higher the hopes move up the sky. Today now, it's been treated as the truer self of constructivism. That finally, after years of meta-theoretical debates, constructivism has finally found itself in looking at practices. And I think here, problem starts. I have to be honest and say what my version of constructivism is, because there are different versions around, and depends on which way you subscribe, you come up with different solutions. I mean, if you subscribe to the moderate new orthodoxy, well, then, of course, practice theory are fancier and interesting, and they're, by definition, a move forward. Personally, why should I bother of reviving ancient structure again and again and again? Because I thought it was a false start to begin with. The same with norms and ideas. What the literature started with and how it turned out in the 80s or late 90s was just not what I think conceptually sound. So constructivism for me is, first of all, trying to understand the social beyond the nation state. How can we understand relationships beyond the nation states apart from just subsuming it under the concept of anarchy, or itself seeing anarchy as some kind of social narrative or enterprise or concept. That said, first of all, the social is not a nice concept. It's not some kind of happy land where everybody is enjoying themselves and are peacefully dancing around the fire and somehow live peacefully ever after. No, the social kills, it excludes, it includes, it always does both. It's brutal. It's a fight and it's a struggle. And it comes with power. And the social and power are always two sides of the same coin. That's what I think is at the core of the constructivism as I understand it, which then also ties in with the constructivist ideas or interests in identities, subjectivations, identity, alterity. You may come across the questions of othering, which also methodologically demands you to realize the contingency of your own position and not actually have a normative standpoint a priori, which if there is such a thing, but to include the contingency of different perspectives in the way you do actually science. And the third way is then to take seriously the linguistic turn, which means that language provides us an access to the intersubjectivity, which essentially, in the shortcut version, says that all these this shebang about concepts, discourses, speech act is important for understanding practical problems and the construction of the past, present, and the future. From here, this is my standpoint. I would say we can identify four nails in the coffin of the practice turn. Now, where do these nails come from? Well, they come from Latour himself. He wrote in 98 a piece on recalling ANT where he tried to bury ANT, which is the avant-garde version of the practice term, and says, well, there are four things that don't work with ANT: the actor, the network, the theory, and the hyphen. And I think that is still true. And from that, let me proceed to the four nails. The first nail, I think, is there's a deep empiricism at work when it comes to practice. The idea that you just look and see what's happening is, well, in a sense, very deep theoretical. I mean, even Popper, talking about the LSE, stepped beyond that and said, well, I think he opened always his lectures by saying, observe. And then students became nervous. What should they observe? Eels, glasses, whatever. So already, and says, see, there is no just observation. You always need something already directing your perspective in order to actually make sense of the world. That doesn't make me a Popper, or I don't want to defend Popper, but you don't need to be a fancy postmodern or constructivist in order to see that empiricism in that sense has its problems. And even if you want to defend empiricism, you cannot just simply assume all these debates away by saying, well, I'm just doing practice. And I have nothing to do with what has been said and done for the last 50 or 100 years, because it's not action theory and it's not behavior, it's practice. But never bother to define what the differences are. Just say, we're different. That's it. And it's interesting to see that in when they come to or write about methodological problems, it's all about making it explicit. Well, making it explicit, making tacit knowledge explicit, is not a problem genuine to the practice theory. And it's not genuinely, it's a debate that goes on and has been going on for quite some time in the analytic philosophy of mind. And now here, I think, one problem arises. It gives prerogative to the subject. There is a superiority to the individual through which you try to make explicit what is intersubjective tacitly knowing. So you lose the entire intersubjectivity problem that constructivists try to deal with in the first place. So now you could, of course, turn around, and people do that, and say, well, no, tacit knowledge, people that they don't can really formalize, that's the intersubjective. Well, I think it's a foul. Why? It's the same move that the moderate constructivist did when with norms. It's a difference whether you assume or ask yourself how ego and alter as two actants try to make sense of their presence and how they are able to communicate and what the structural limits are and what kind of power relations are already inscribed in order to make them actually communicate, the signal systems, the kind of language that they have, or when you say, well, the intersubjective is norms, and norms are an objective force that an individual state is now faced with, and he has to either comply with that norm or not. It's a different problem. It's a completely different understanding of how norms are and what norms work. And the same, I think, is in play with the practice term. The second is then that it leaves the observer unexplained. Practice theorists notoriously leave unexplained their own positionality. Latour, I mean, if you read Latour, it's fun to read. I mean, read more Latour in the sense, yes, okay. But he goes to the lab and observes. He goes to the court and observes. Does he ever take into account his own position and his own positionality in making that possible? 2 minutes? Oh, my God. No. And he cannot. Why? And I was hoping that Ivor Neumann was here. he published a paper on about practices of model as models. Now, interestingly, as soon as you give up that crude empiricism at work, what does Ivan Neumann do? He leaves the terrain of practice theory and comes back to Weber's ideal types. So it's not practice theory which is actually then providing the inclusion of their own perspective. Third nail, and I have to hurry up, is a reduced concept of order. It's the empiricism that it's work with at practices somehow assume that the order and things are there. You go to a court, you go to an embassy in order to understand diplomacy. Well, but that's already given institution, given life rules. It's a different set of problems from constructivists who are interested in the making possible of institutions and the making possible of life rules and the power relations inscribed in them. So for constructivists, what's always inherent part of any order and ordering practice, if you want to call it, are the silences, the exclusions, and the marginalizations that go on with every stabilization of every order that's part of international relations. Just to assume that away throws power and therefore, for me, politics out of the window. That, for me, gives to the fourth nail. I think it's a fake. It's a lie. Because why? Practice theories never talk about their own practices. They move it and they use it as a theoretical argument, and it's treated as a theoretical argument. Nobody's interested in Latour's, really, whether his description of the Conseil d'Etat or whether his description of the laboratory is actually correct or whether it's reasonable. No, we're interested in the theoretical concepts that he provides to advance theoretical arguments. That means also, I mean, we could ask ourselves, is the writing on practice theory actually part of the practice turn? Do they need to adhere to their own standards? So do they need to write about their tacit knowledge when they write papers? Well, probably they should. Do they? No, never. Why? Because they're not bothered. Because it's a theoretical argument. Secondly, I mean, also, I mean, if they practice, one of the proponents says, everything about practice theory starts with induction. Surprise. I mean, that's a news. Induction. Okay, induction. But the paper argues deductively. Now, is that now part of the problem or not? It's a self-contradiction. They run all the time in performative contradictions. They never do what they say. And here I think they fall behind Derrida or Foucault or Luhmann, who always performed the text through their writings. They were always doing, the text were always playing on two levels. And that's what I think practice turn loses. So 1 minute? 1 minute?
Can you be happy now?
I am happy. I am happy. So what's the politics of it? It's, I think, academic politics. And it's the turn. And here the turn, and it's mirrors here. The turn is always something. I read something, and please listen to me. It's always in the future. It's always, oh, I have a normative force by being part of a turn. And please take it important. It's important. No, it is important because it's a turn. And I think it's wrong. Why? Because it comes always with the same power games and the same normative standpoints that somebody tells you what to think, what to write, and what to believe in. And we are academics just not to do that. So the entire turn business is the wrong starting point. So the way forward is to stop this nonsense with turns. Start with the problems. Say, what is the problem? What are the concept of social that we actually are adequate to understand things? And then compare different social theories that what they bring to the table. But that means constructivism is never there. It's never finished and it's never ending project because the problems change, the theoretical concepts adequate to understand them change. So you can never say that this is a done deal. And that's a good thing. Why? Because it gives you the liberty to explore your own mind and do what you want to do without telling you somebody else you should adhere to a turn which has to be kept pure and tiny, and you should just communicate to your friends and cite your friends and not the others because they are the enemies. I think if we stop this, the future looks bright. Thank you.
that was fun. Someone should maybe give Ivor a call and give him the gist of Oliver's remarks, and we could really have a nice conversation. But we'll take it a little bit further than that. I mean, I've got questions I'd like to ask, but I won't hog the floor. We've got about 35, 40 minutes, so we could start by just gathering up some initial thoughts and questions. If you could wait for the mic to come round, that would be wonderful, and possibly tell people who you are and where you're coming from, that would be even more wonderful. So who would like to get us started?
I killed it.
I think you scared everyone, Oliver.
Yeah, probably. That's what Germans do. Scare everybody up.
You've got some questions, though, George.
Do you want me to throw them out? Oops. Okay. The question for Aisha, I like the threefold ideas of where innovation comes from, its methodological, its labelling, and it's borrowed from other disciplines. But I didn't get why you ended up with something necessarily being more promising if it generates transhistorical concepts and dynamics across space and time, and why that would necessarily be different. Given that you've done so much historical work and you're interested in, you said global history is one potential interdisciplinary conversation that could be innovative, why not actually much more grounded, granular, rooted in time and place type of work? Wouldn't that be innovative? And IR's own historical imaginary is often pretty unimaginative. So why not that hard grafting type of historical work rather than necessarily big macro, big pictures and grand claims about the 19th century that can't possibly stand up, but more kind of empirical innovations, not necessarily in the American database sense, but in the more substantive historical sense? Why do you want those transhistorical concepts? What about that more granular form of history? For Elizabeth, I thought that was fascinating. And I learned a lot. The only bit that I didn't quite get, maybe I misheard, is why you said we needed to go back to Marx for state theory. I would have thought there's a lot of other people you could go to state theory before you went to Marx. I mean, you could go to Jessop, right, who's Marxian, and it comes via Althusser and Gramsci. So did you mean Marxian, or did you mean Marx? I didn't quite get Marx and state theory, because I would have thought that was one of the weakest parts of the apparatus. Matthew, that was also very interesting. Why, if a field is small and relatively new, could it not also be innovative? I mean, why would it, do you require some type of security or some type of foundations in order to be innovative? I mean, maybe those fields actually get less innovative as they get more foundational because they tend to just get on with normal science. Possibly a small subset of the discipline or a particular type of issue area has more scope to be innovative because it is relatively open in terms of where it looks for its concepts and categories and historical explanations and so on. And I was trying to think, I don't know if other people were, about whether there have been innovations that come from IP to IR rather than the other way around. I mean, regime theory came more from IPE, didn't it? I don't find it very interesting at all, but I mean, regime theory was something that came out of IP more than IR, and then IR latched onto, I would have thought, and Susan Strange clearly didn't think much of it, but her own work was clearly quite innovative and was influential on the emergence of various forms of structural theory and so on. And I would have thought the whole work on institutions and historical institutionalism and so on has had more scope in IP than IR. So I did wonder whether it was such a one-way traffic from IR to IP or whether there wasn't some traffic that went the other way too. I mean, the issue areas themselves are often extremely interesting. I think about the recent work on Shell, on tax havens and shell companies and so on, and the methodological innovation, one of Aisha's categories that comes from that, the type of experimental stuff or Jason Sharman stuff, strikes me as extremely innovative. Oliver, I don't really have a question for you. I didn't quite get why constructivism has to only look beyond the nation state, but I mean, I think that's just your take on why you think it's important, right? In which case, it's not a particularly general point. I just couldn't follow why a particular type of constructivism couldn't be perfectly at home with state-society complexes or various type of things that go on around the state, which is itself a type of social complex, a type of assemblage that's socially formed. So that was my only a minor point. Then I was just caught up in your diatribe, really, and quite enjoying it, and wishing Ivor was here. Those are my initial remarks. Does that prompt anyone else to throw something out? Peter, yeah.
Thank you very much for four very interesting presentations, which I have to say I found rather pessimistic. It seems to me that if innovation is very close to progress and knowledge, the discipline over the last 98 years has made enormous progress, and we sometimes undersell ourselves. We have far more sophisticated understandings of the state of intervention, of the balance of power, the promises and pitfalls of international organization, the relationship between economics and politics, imperialism, colonialism. The list is a very long one. If you look at the early understandings of these things in the 20s and 30s, right through really to the 50s and 60s, they're incredibly primitive compared to the ones we have today. So I think, contrary to the message that I received from some speakers, that we should give ourselves a pat on the back and congratulate ourselves for furthering knowledge in international relations very considerably.
There we go. Federica.
Thank you. I suppose I cannot pretend to be either, but I think that I'll speak just for myself and why I like practice approaches and why I like doubling with them. First of all, I've never read Latour, and I'm not going to read Latour. I'm coming in to practice approaches from organizational theories, Powell and DiMaggio, all that sort of stuff, and therefore I'm not really sure I see fully the target of what Oliver you're saying. It seems to me that you're going for sort of the practice theory in a very sort of a restricted group of people and arguments, and I have also spoken about you know, the need to open up and democratize practice approaches, but I wouldn't throw away the concept, you know, together with some of its applications, if only because I find it liberating, I find it useful, the fact that it might be empiricist or that it might not be as perfect as you want it doesn't mean that I personally don't see the beauty in it. And I was born a social constructivist at first, but I have encountered a number of limitations in that work too, and therefore I believe that it is slightly ironic that you finish by saying, by telling us what not to do, and you tell us that practice approaches actually are too preachy.
So the first question there was from Peter Wilton, the second was from Federica Bicchi, both of whom teach in the department. I wonder if a student would be brave enough to round things off. Thanks. Adrian.
Adrian, student in the IR department. A question for Oliver and partly for Aisha, because there's obviously a connection to what you say about the practice turn and it being a method, an innovation, partly because we have to call things innovations in order for them to become kind of, you know, innovation is a socially constructed thing, right? It might be old wine in new bottles, but we have to call it new and exciting things because of academic politics, partly, you know. So the question is, how do we get away from that? Can we get away from that? How do we get beyond academic politics in that way?
Thanks. Why don't we pause for a minute and give you some chance to respond? Should we just go down the line from Matthew coming this way? Is that all right, Matthew?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, George. I think you're absolutely right that there's no necessary reason why a small field might not be innovative. I wonder, however, when looking at my own field at IPE, what there is, in one sense, to be innovative against. Mm. I think to be innovative, you need to be innovative for something. There is going to be an approach that you're trying to produce and also to present to other people. But you also maybe have to be innovative against something. There is an underlying narrative of corrective that's built into most claims about innovation. Mm. Not only doing something differently, but doing something differently to correct what's already done. I suspect with the field of IPE at the moment, however, that it's so fragmented that it's very difficult to be able to distinguish formally between pieces of work that are just pieces of work and pieces of work that are making a claim on their own behalf. I think it's also difficult to distinguish pieces of work that are taking the subject field forward against something that's already established as what the subject field is. Mm. I'm really just not sure that there's that level of coherence or actually self-identity at an intellectual level. I actually think this is quite encouraging. I quite like the fact that there are still lots of careers to be made in the way that people want to make them. I don't get a sense that there are established lines of argument within IPE that weigh on people, that sit on their shoulders and force them into line. And I think this is actually a very good thing. If we go back once more to Susan Strange, her idea about the field was that it should remain an open range, that it should be there for anyone with any background to try to make a contribution to the debates about the world economy and how the world economy and its management structure filters down to the level of everyday life. And I think that IPE scholars as a whole maybe are in a position to be able to deal with both of those aspects of the world economy. I don't think it's necessarily the case that everyone individually will do both aspects of that, but I think that there is scope for people as a whole to do both. So I'm actually quite optimistic about the future of IPE simply because there don't seem to be too many furrows that are ploughed over and over and over again. And I think that probably is a relative advantage of youth in that regard. I don't think there are many settled debates that become an instinctive means through which we try to train the next generation of IPE scholars. So I wouldn't want to sit here. I probably was one of the people that came across as being overly pessimistic. Sorry about that, Peter. But I really wasn't trying to be. I think that the lack of established lines of argument is maybe a good thing.
Thanks.
Yes, of course. Marx as picked up by many different people, including Bob Jessop and Althusser and all those good people, including the feminist state theorists. I'm thinking of Birgit Sauer in Vienna in particular, and it's almost a Vienna school around feminist state theory. What I have in mind here in particular also in, somebody who doesn't actually identify explicitly as a feminist state theorist, and that's Nancy Fraser. And Nancy Fraser has emphasized and reminded us of the peril of being stuck in identity politics, of pointing out that power relations in not just in international affairs, but also in domestic affairs are not just about the way in which we identify and the way in which identities are productive of power, but there is a distributional element to power and the danger of doing too much for Foucault. And I think, Oliver, you're right on that. It's a good thing to be eclectic on these things, is that you would forget that distributional element that is clearly out there.
Thank you for the questions, and especially thank you, George. I ran out of time before I could land my conclusion, so your question gives me the opportunity to make my case. I don't mean to imply that histories or historical approaches or empirical studies grounded in a particular time and place, I don't mean to imply that they don't have a place in international relations. My general approach to IR is a big tent approach. I think everybody should do whatever they want to do. At the same time, somebody has to every now and then take stock of, you know, the big picture and identify big historical trends and patterns, and if, you know, we're going through, arguably, as Matthew said, a period of flux, possibly systemic change. And I think IR is uniquely well positioned to be the discipline because of its relations with all these other disciplines and because of its interdisciplinary orientations. I think international relations is the best discipline where those conversations could be had. And unfortunately, because of the way the field has evolved, we're always late to that conversation. Some sociologists engage in it, some historians, but we're not really there. And I think actually we could be there, and we could be, we could be the people who innovate in that particular conversation, because we are uniquely positioned to come up with trans-historical concepts and generalizations. I guess it's my American training, but I don't think we should be shying away from making generalizations just because we've been making bad generalizations. I think there's a lot of room for improvement there. In terms of the pessimism and whether we've developed much more sophisticated understandings of a number of issue areas, I suppose I would agree. I do think there's been progress. But, in my talk, I was arguing against this notion that each generation has, that what they're doing is uniquely novel, and nobody before had ever, considered this problem, and we are, the first ones to realize, race matters in international relations or something. I think that innovation speak, or the novelty speak, actually, or the turns, get in the way of real innovation. And if we weren't always trying to construct that argument, maybe we would be reading older stuff and realize that, yes, in some ways they were more primitive. But in some areas, when it comes to, for instance, conceptualization of hierarchy or status, I don't know, in some areas they were more sophisticated, and we've forgotten the contributions of previous generations because everybody stays in their turn or their corner and doesn't really read what other people have done. So I always tell, and that gets me to Adrian's question, how do we get beyond it? I always tell my students to read beyond that immediate debate. And then actually maybe you don't have to keep reinventing the wheel. And then imagine the progress we would have made if we weren't always coming, every generation wasn't, coming up with brilliant innovation, and we were making, gradual progress that built on other people's work. So that's my take on that issue.
Does this work? This one? Does it work? Well, thank you. Thanks for the questions. Now, the primary question that I pursued was, are practice theories the new self of constructivism? And I hope to have shown it's not. For me, it would be a kiss of death, probably. Does that mean that practice theories are to be turned away, back to the bookshelf, never looked at? No, of course not. If you want to work with some author, there is always something. It's good, or it's the right tool for some questions, and it's not good for other questions. And the primary, what comes first is the question. So, for example, I'm just writing a paper where I do use a practice theory when it comes to how legal expertise kicks in and how that limits access to files. So how files and data are collective, and then in one point in time there is legal expertise coming in, and then there is a lawyer in charge of that file. Before that, they were all interns. And interns can come from all over the world, and they can do from all other disciplines, and they do all the fact findings, and then see how that file is put together and how it's made translatable and then be able to move. So yes, I can work with practice theory, but I don't need to do that as the new turn. The same thing, I can do a paper now on how coevolution of professions and social legal or of social fields, how the economy translates or is shifting with paradigm shifts in economics, the entire performativity literature. Another question, not a tool, not a social theories. So I was not saying don't use it or they're useless. No, I say if you treat them as the new constructivism, there are certain limitations that you have to be aware of in order to actually talk, and not just subsume them, ignore them by just saying, we are new, we are the new kids in town, and we are so innovative, and we don't have anything to do with what has been written before. I mean, it's quite ironic that the first practice, I mean, there are not even, I think, some practice theories would be, or theorists would actually probably benefit from reading Austrian economics of the 1920s, because they were practice theorists, avant la lettre, so to say. But that they come from a very conservative social theory is maybe a case in point about the inherent politics of the givenness of the social order and the apologetic approach to it, I think. The second point is then about the innovations. And, I mean, the one point probably that I want to make and want to do is that, come on, how do debates look like these days? Yeah. There is somebody has mastered one author, and he sticks to him most of the time for the rest of his academic career and fights his terrain against other theories. Most of the time by fighting those fights. So you fight the fight from Bourdieu and Foucault, and you repeat it, and then you say, well, the Foucauldians don't get it because Bourdieu already said that this is the case. So you're already part of a machinery where not the question and the problem that you want to tackle is first, but the academic positioning in the field. And I think if you want to break away from that academic politics, well, then don't try to establish maybe an identity that you have to. If you want to, I mean, for example, I mean, there are people who, with good reasons. I have no problem studying Kant for the next 50 years because I admire this guy. Does it need to be my identity? No. If somebody wants to have an identity on that, fine. You know, that's the point. But don't tell me I have to. And don't tell me I have to cite those my friends and not the others. Or, oh, I should be all for Bourdieu because Bourdieu are now my friends, and I should, by definition, there find Foucault limited. I think different questions, different problems, different strategies. Don't try to establish an identity as some, which I think now that's how IR works. You are the guy who, or the scholar, or the female, or the girl, exactly, that's what, sir, the guy or the girl, who's the expert on something. And then you need a chapter on Bourdieu, and you ask that person whether they could contribute a chapter on that. And I think this is what limits us. This is what limits us. So the normative point probably is to say, well, yes, read the old stuff. I mean, Simmel, Mannheim, Durkheim, they're all brilliant. But read not just one guy, but read the entire social theory. And then you see connections and things that you probably don't get by just sticking to what you or any other, or Luhmann, or somebody else for the next 50 years and defend your terrain just for the sake of it, for having a name in the discipline. That's it. And I don't see that, first of all, this is a very curious or very fruitful, why should I want that? And third, it kills off so many interesting questions. So that's the only point that I try to make.
So read all social theory and you'll be fine. Yeah. Okay, there's some hands coming up. I mean, I can see at least three themes. We'll see what other people are coming back with. And one is to take on Peter's challenge. Is there progress? I guess both theoretically and in terms of our understanding of particular issue areas, which there's some agreement about at least. Is it cumulative or not? I'm not sure, but certainly a sense of progress. The second one is about the more structure of the discipline, structure of the social science point, whether innovation comes from actually having a coherent, relatively settled idea of what you're doing, like economics and to some extent like history, I guess, and then the innovation comes from substantive research once that domain is fairly settled. Does it come from this more open-ended enterprise that Matthew is raising and to some extent I think Oliver is talking about? Except the danger of the open-ended enterprise is that everyone gets to have their corporate identity, everyone gets to occupy their corner and doesn't get to speak to anybody else, I guess, which is part of the rationale behind that EJIR special issue on the end of IR theory a few years ago. The third one, which I actually took from Adrian's question, is what is innovation anyway? What does pure innovation look like in a social science, whether it's relatively recent or relatively established, whichever one you would place IR in, I'm not sure. But what does innovation look like? Is it always a question of labeling, concept formation? Is it some type of substantive type of contribution? Now, what does innovation look like? I might ask the people who organized this whole panel to come back on that in a minute, but there were other people who wanted to come in first. I saw Yanina and then Gustav. Yeah, so Yanina. It's right there, the other way.
So this is a question for Oliver Kessler as well. I'm not sure I 100% understand the nature of your grievance about moderate constructivism, but I take it to be something along the lines of it is incoherent to marry proper constructivism with an empiricist epistemology or with the lack of problematizing your standpoint, problematizing knowledge. And what I wonder is whether your own, you know, problem with that combination of an ontological commitment to the constructedness of the world and then a lack of problematizing knowledge, whether that isn't itself an exercise of academic imperialism, right? That you need to be have this constructivist label reserved for the kind of research that you think is the correct one. Because if you really wanted to say that this is per se incoherence, what you owe us is a meta-theoretical argument about the incoherence of marrying certain ontologies with certain epistemologies, or the notion that one prejudges the other, right? Even if I'm on board with that, which I tend to actually be, and think that the constructedness of the world in some way predisposes that, you know, you have to reject particularly crude types of empiricism, couldn't I still argue that in my own research, for pragmatic reasons, every now and then, I have to bracket certain implications of my epistemological stance simply to be able to productively engage with the world? And I think part of the reason for why we have or continue to have this kind of moderate partially empiricist, partially positivist constructivism is because of the lack of critical approaches of producing anywhere near as sophisticated an alternative methodology for us to productively engage with the world and to produce any kind of conception of what is progress, what is accumulation of progress, what is communication among different scholars and their scholarship look like if you're true to the critical epistemology.
Thanks,
I have a question that relates to that other thing that academics do and in which they quite literally state the state of the discipline, namely teaching. And I was wondering whether or not some of the pathologies of the discipline and also potential sources of innovation lie actually in the sort of the literal stating of the discipline to students.
Thank you. Just behind you, right there on the right.
Eva Ganjavelati, student. Question for Professor Kessler, which kind of mirrors Professor Doe's question. So basically the question is how, if you want to justify that idea of, you know, mirroring social theories or, you know, doing anything like that, is that your only answer methodologically to be a constructivist and say it's all fine? And the question is, comes from the idea that I agree with you largely on, you know, how we've gone down this path of people specializing, and really when we see where the basic ideas of our social sciences come from, they come from people who didn't specialize. You know, you look at Adam Smith or you look at Marx, you look at people that were kind of the founding fathers of our basic patterns of thought, and they weren't specialists in anything, but they also didn't have to justify their methodologies to an academic panel or to a supervisor or to an application for a PhD, for example. So, you know, if I want to go and do something like that and I want to justify it methodologically, what do I do? You know, do I just say I'm a constructivist and hope that, you know, that goes through? Or, you know, what do you do? Otherwise, I'm on board with the whole idea of, you know, specializing and all that.
Thanks. Just behind you there.
Thank you very much. I'm Olivia. I'm a graduate student in IR too. I have a question for Professor Kessler too, relating to you. Sorry about that. So you criticize the practice turn, which is killing so many questions. And my question is it not the job of the international relations theorist to precisely kill so many questions and choose to focus on one particular aspect? Because one could argue that you will always lack self-reflection, and being self-reflective about your limitation and your knowledge is very hard. So shouldn't you just go with your theory without providing all the limitation and leave the job to others to destroy it and improve it?
Steve.
I think I agree with a lot of what Matthew was saying.
I would use the mic, Steve, because it's difficult.
In terms of how IP is evolved, the theory of IP seems to have evolved in terms of trying to understand different stages in the evolution of the international economy. But picking up on Peter's point and your theme in terms of whether this is progress, it does seem to me that that's become more sophisticated. Mm. And if you're trying to understand, for example, structural shifts in the international economy now, there's quite a volume of work that helps us understand that by looking at previous structural shifts that took place in the 1980s or other periods in the international economy. So I think I really agree with you on that. The other point, the question I suppose I have really, though, is about, you were talking about, it's a question about schools of thought and whether there's a pluralism within IPE. And it seemed my take is that it's not quite as open as you're presenting it. There is a lot of pressure moving towards a sort of more quantitative IPE, to put it, summarize it. And I think this is the market-based analysis that you mentioned at the end. I think you're a bit too optimistic in terms of how open the discipline is to anyone contributing.
Thanks. Thank you. Pastor Barry. With Barry and then Georgia.
Thanks. Barry Buzan. I guess my standing is a ghost in the corridor around here, but I find this debate has rather more of a parochial quality than I would have expected. Maybe that's a problem with the title. Restating the state of the discipline seems an invitation to go around in circles to me. I very much agreed with Aisha's comments that IR is the place where some of the big debates about where everything is going should be happening. The question is, how do we get there? Several of you mentioned the relationship between power and theory. Aisha, I think, pointed out that IR is a bit American-centric. But putting those two things together seems to me to suggest at least one way of answering that question of how we get there, which is that the discipline has had almost its entire life during a period in which global power has been concentrated in the Anglosphere. Right? That period is coming to an end. What implication does that have for IR as a discipline? I mean, the American dominance of IR is not just methodological, but the whole kind of the way in which history is understood, the predominance of liberal values in the normative aspect of IR theory, all of these things are going to come under increasing question very quickly. They're already coming under question with the help of Donald Trump and the Chinese. So the nature of the discipline is within which it operates is changing, and the subject matter and the normative take are changing. And nobody said anything about it.
Georgia.
Just to follow up on that question, sorry, I'm Georgia Oshani, CIS. Could the panelists say something about the state of the discipline outside of the West? Because there have been some quite big international conferences in Asia in particular, in which constructivism and the various turns of Eurocentric IR theory has not been dominant or hegemonic at all. Thank you.
Is there anybody else? I mean, we're just taking a bunch of contributions here, as you can see. Is anyone else? Because it's probably be the last chance to do so before the panelists get a chance to respond. Do any of the organizers want to say what they meant by innovation? Just so we have. But you don't want to talk about that, Mervyn, do you? You want to say? He's a,
it's just a comment I want to make about Oliver Kessler. I find myself in agreement with a lot of what you said, in particular about this empiricism in the practice turn. But it seems to me that you did leave out a completely different tradition of the practice turn, which relates to this institution, the LSE, that developed by Michael Oakeshott, where the practice, the practices he spoke of and the ones, and this was taken up by Terry Narden, amongst others, who says that we can't understand the subject matter, which is almost always action of one kind or another, if you don't take the wider social practice within which that action is located. And that involves the internal point of view. So it seems to me that the practice turn you criticized are these people who, as it were, think you come along and look externally at what's going on, as opposed to understanding it from the internal point of view of a participant in the practice. So I think you left out this other tradition. And by the way, I'm Mervyn Frost from War Studies across the way. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Mervyn. Okay, we've got a few minutes for people to respond. And then what's going to happen is the organizers are going to come up and answer that question on innovation, plus say whatever else they want to say. And then we'll wrap up. So you've got, you can feel free to take 2 or 3 minutes each. Why don't we start, go the other way? So, Oliver, why don't you start, and we'll work our way down to
Mervyn. Okay.
Oliver needs 10 minutes, I think.
No, he doesn't need time. It's all there.
No. why should I? I tried to make sense of a lot of what's thrown out there. It's nice that I apparently hit a nerve. That's nice to see. So, see, to you, I mean, what's for you the PhD panel on review is for us the reviewer when we try to get something published. And it looks to me, and I feel old, or getting old, or depressed, but, I mean, how increasingly I ever get reviews that say, oh, I like this paper very much because it's exactly what I want to say. Or I don't like the paper very much because I don't say what he says. And so I think there is a lot, the danger that we lose or set some, or that it becomes normal to not engage with other arguments on their own ground for their own sake and realize or accept a good argument, even if it's in disagreement with our own. And I hope that your PhD supervisor would accept your argument on the basis of the sound internal coherence of the paper without saying, oh, but I'm doing Bourdieu, you're doing Foucault, so therefore you're wrong. I hope that that doesn't solve your practical problem of passing it, but I hope that you have, my love, my support, you have all that. About imperialism, of course, I was talking too long already. To talk about all the metatheoretical problems that come with self-reflexivity takes another 25 minutes. And I say, of course, you can throw at me. The logic of the argument that you threw at me, which is fine. You can say, is essentially to argue that there is no universal truth, presupposes a universal truth, EA, there is no universal truth. To argue that I'm not a believer in God is a religious argument. That's the same kind of argument, or the logic of the structure of that, what you just said. Of course, it's fine, but the question is then how we continue on. Nevertheless, if you want to know where my meta-theoretical stance comes from, it has a lot to do with Gotthard Günther's self-reflexive semiotics and von Förster's double cybernetics, if that's my thing. And of course, that presupposes, or in a nutshell, says that reflexivity assumes that you are able to observe the contingency of your own perspective inside the conceptual framework in which you use, and not claim an objective position by using concepts which are not able to re-entry. So that's, in a nutshell, is my thing. I do hope, however, that this was not imperialistic, and it was not meant as a new imperialism, and if it was, then I hope we have the chance to talk about it at the party that is supposed to follow.
Okay, thank you. Aisha.
Thank you. In terms of, breaking the discipline out of its, American centricism or Anglo-centricism, I agree with everything you said, Barry. And I think because the international system is changing, and for the reasons that you stated, it's become in recent years possible to make a lot of progress in terms of correcting the Eurocentricism or the Western centricism in the assumptions of our theories. When I rage against Eurocentricism to my students, I make the argument that this is a methodological problem. It leads us to create theories that cannot explain the future and other parts of the world, and that argument finds much more resonance now because the system's changing. People can't just say, oh, you know, the West is still dominating and it will dominate forever. You know, why do I have to learn about other places? That argument no longer holds. So I think some of that is a corrective and it's for, you know, pushing us out of our comfort zone. And I think we will come up with better theories, better generalizations as a result of those systemic changes. At the same time, that is easier said than done, because, you know, going to this question about state of the discipline outside of the West, I mean, the particular hierarchies of the international system were also reflected in academia. So it's not enough to bring Chinese scholars in or Brazilian or Turkish scholars in when many of those scholars have also been trained in the U.S. and are still speaking in these very stunted, weird paradigm, you know, speak. And they're like trying to shoehorn like Chinese history or into like Chinese realism or something instead of starting from the basics and reconceptualizing some of the theories. So that's, I think, where we are now. But I think the future is brighter. I think, you know, after this stage, people will start theorizing in a more ambitious way as opposed to just, you know, speaking to American journals. And that's my take on that.
Thank you.
Okay. I'm going to start off with something that Matthew said, actually. You raised the alternative facts issue. The issue of alternative facts is interesting for different reasons. For those of us who have made the post-positivist turn, say that, are post-positivists, in a way, we have all along precisely argued that there is not just one positive, simple truth. There's different ways of looking at the world. So when we are now confronted with somebody who is powerful and who knows how to lie extensively, presenting us with a notion of alternative facts, I think it raises for me the big notion of reflexivity. So that doesn't necessarily tell me something about what is happening with this change in world order, which is happening. But there is in that change in world order a narrative going on that is also about questioning what our current wisdom is. I'm not trying to suggest that Trump is a post-positivist, because he just simply is a liar. But I think what is strikingly interesting about the current situation in which we are finding ourselves in is how poorly trained and how incapable we actually are in acting reflexively, in thinking about what we know and what we don't know as part of a particular historical juncture. And it is in that context. I mean, this is of course something that feminists have basically claimed all along, of saying the main feminist contribution to the discipline of IR is to suggest a different kind of methodology to think of knowledge as anchored in a particular standpoint. I have a hard time from that position to think about or to think that IR really has had so much innovation. The kind of thinking that we are doing is we are interpreting the world for ourselves, and those interpretations, in my opinion, have to always be embedded in a particular historical situation. So, and here, I find this to be, in order to be practical, let me put this way, in order to be practical, I find that one of the most important things that we should be engaging now, it, in this particular historical time is to learn how to be more modest about our knowledge claims and to be more reflexive as to where they are coming from. That's not an answer to your question about the discipline as not taking on voices from other places, but I think it is related. And it is also something that the question, Gustav's question about teaching, I think, goes in that direction. To me, teaching is a very, very important part of what we do as scholars. It is about interpreting contemporary knowledge and about also disturbing that contemporary knowledge. And if we would be teaching better, more, or maybe less, I would hope that we would not see the current excessive othering that seems to be driving this moment in history.
Thank you. Matthew?
I'll pick up, I hope, on one or two of the bigger questions. The question of whether there's progress, well, I certainly hope that the answer's yes, because if the answer isn't yes, I suspect that's an indictment on all of us. We do, after all, exist in a time where there's more intellectual effort that's being devoted to these sorts of questions than ever before. And it would be an almighty shame to think that that intellectual effort wasn't taking us, in some sense, forwards. I think we all have to recognise that we stand at the end of very rich traditions of thought, and that those traditions of thought themselves maybe have to become part of the research programme. Maybe this is an element of that degree of reflexivity. One of the things that I've been very keen to try to bring to my own work is a much more conscious understanding of the historical origins of particular economic concepts. The economic concepts that we use, the vocabulary through which we converse with one another over economic matters, and to begin to understand that they are not rooted and were never in their originating forms rooted in an abstraction called the economy. They were rooted in a particular set of historical circumstances. Most of those concepts were drawn when the economy that was being described was necessarily an imperial economy. And I think we can understand more about our own traditions and the language that we use theoretically by engaging in that degree of historical research. So progress itself might be an interesting multidimensional thing. I suspect that progress maybe invites us to look backwards as much as it invites us to look forwards. And I think that progress might enable us, in one sense, to become more comfortable knowing the lineage of thought that we actually exist within. So the subsidiary question of whether that progress is cumulative, I'm not actually sure I would know exactly what cumulative would mean within that context. I probably would say that I hope that it's not cumulative, because cumulative to me implies a process of looking only one way, and that might restrict ourselves from also looking backwards to begin to challenge the conceptual basis that we use to converse with one another. Hopefully that sort of work is also reflected in my teaching. I have the great good fortune of working at Warwick, where we have 18 members of full-time faculty within the International Political Economy cluster, and therefore we don't have the same sorts of pressures as other people who teach IPE in smaller departments have, where they will almost certainly be the only IPE scholar. They're the only IPE scholar who teaches the only IPE course, and the only IPE course therefore has to somehow cover the whole of the discipline. If you cover the whole of the discipline like that, it's very easy to fall back on a formulaic approach in which you're giving a broad brush of probably not too much at all Whereas what we're able to do, because there are so many of us, is to think of how coordination in our curriculum might be developed, and we can all teach a smaller amount of things but in greater depth. So I think that I am particularly lucky in that respect. My last word, I've been fascinated by the conversation on innovation. Mm. Probably I could have contributed a bit more to it if I'd have thought of following what we were asked to do, which was to talk about innovation. But it seems to me that the language of innovation that we've been using maybe cuts across two completely different things. Is innovation something that can be self-appointed, self-declared? Is it something that is obvious in any sense in the here and now? How would you be able to identify an innovation in its first iteration? Or is an innovation something that only becomes apparent over time, something that can't be claimed ahead of time, but is ascribed after the fact? And I'm not sure I ever really needed to think about that before, but the whole conversation as it's developed has helped me to do that. So thank you very much to everyone.
Thank you. Before we thank the speakers formally, the organisers would like to come up and just say a couple of words.
The words we have are mostly about thanks. We each have something we'd like to say. On innovations, we might have different ideas of what we meant in the beginning. For me, we meant something about change, something akin to change, difference, and event, and we were hoping we'd leave it up to you to clarify what innovations arise. Yes, maybe. and what the criteria for identifying them are. The idea behind the event was my assigned speaking topic. Our notion was that being in a department ideally involves getting together as a department. And we are thinking this is ideal because it's conducive to our collective sense of self as a department and a discipline and a family of disciplines. And we have an enormous amount of people to thank for making this little event possible.
Yeah, I don't think it's good if all of us talk about what we meant with innovations, but I think this roundtable was meant to be an innovation in that it's an inaugural event, and here I will look at Peter and say that we hope that this becomes a tradition at the LSE, that this is a roundtable that we have every year, that we gather people in the department, a full-day event, because we know we have Cumberland Lodge, but this is on campus on a weekday, so it's more possible for everyone to attend. And we hope that next year we can invite people, a wider range of voices as well. And part of the innovation is how we reflect about innovations.
And also research clusters in IR department reached out to government and to European Institute in the case of my cluster. It was enormously rewarding to have those intellectual conversations across LSE, which I experienced on a weekly basis. I want to thank everyone from those departments who came and who made research cluster experience extremely, extremely rewarding. So that's something we want to do moving forward.
So it's left to me to thank all of you for coming down, to thank the cluster coordinators, our ushers, our pianist, our guests, and before I ask you to make a last thank you to our speakers and to George and to Peter and to Tarek, that we have a end of term department drinks coming up now. So with that finalized, thank you very much, everybody.
Before people go, just one final remark, which is the point of the clusters, it's really interesting to hear you guys talk about how creative and innovative it's been, is not meant to say that conversations don't go much wider than that, whether they're interdisciplines. And I purposely didn't introduce the speakers as champions of a particular cluster, and it wasn't so that you guys could get out there guessing, you know, who was who. The point was, every conversation we have is clearly going to exceed a particular cluster, and so it should, and the whole point of, for faculty and staff is that they belong usually, almost always, to more than one and have those conversations that are intellectually rich and take us where they may take us, as we have done today. I mean, one remark that before we move down to the drinks and so on, I guess it would be remiss not to mention the attacks yesterday. I mean, that is one example of how a cluster couldn't possibly own a particular important issue area in world politics, how we need insights from all sorts of different parts of the discipline and beyond the discipline in order to begin to understand and explain what's taken place. And someone who I don't normally agree with, who's Prime Minister, I think made a very fine speech in Parliament this morning. And one thing she said, which has really stuck with me, is that the response to terrorism is to take part in millions of acts of normality. And a very nice line, I think. And I think there is almost nothing more normal to academic pursuit than taking part in the type of conversation that we've had today in this open, collegial spirit and with one of scholarly exchange at its forefront, except perhaps to follow scholarly exchange with scholarly refreshment. So the two parts together give us our couple of, at least acts of normality, which are particularly fitting on a day like today. So where you need to go, but you need to go slowly because they're just setting up at the moment. So take your time, look around the room, have a chat, and then slowly make your way down through the building to the atrium, which is more or less at the entrance. People will show you if you don't know exactly where it is, and we'll certainly be open for business by 6:30, possibly a little bit before then. But please do have your conversations as you go. Come and grab the speakers if they're willing to do so, and continue the conversations in the various different forums that we have available to us. So thank you very much for coming. Thank you very much to you guys.